I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
A year ago, my life had collapsed around me. I'd worked myself into exhaustion. My father died suddenly, and my relationships were in turmoil. Little did I know at the time, out of my greatest despair was to come the greatest gift.
If that clip spoke to you, then I'm happy to say that it's your lucky day. Because I'm about to tell you the secret to success. All you have to do is think really hard about your dreams. But don't think too hard about how it works, because then you'll unthink it from existence. Scientifically, of course. If that explanation wasn't enough for you, you can read more about it in Rhonda Byrne's 2006 bestseller, The Secret. That book is an Oprah-approved self-help hit dedicated to the less-than-scientific art of manifesting your dreams. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. This week on Podcast Playlist, we're sharing some of our greatest hits, the episodes we just can't get out of our heads. We're starting off with the podcast, If Books Could Kill. Here's hosts Michael and Peter breaking down why manifestation might just be wishful thinking.
So what is the secret? The secret, it is revealed, is the law of attraction. Mm. She quotes Bob Proctor, aforementioned philosopher and personal coach. Quote, everything that's coming into your life, you are attracting into your life.
Oh my God.
And it's attracted to you by virtue of the images you're holding in your mind. It's what you're thinking. Whatever is going on in your mind, you are attracting to you. Byrne later says, quote, thoughts are magnetic and thoughts have a frequency. As you think, those thoughts are sent out into the universe and they magnetically attract all like things
yes.
that are on the same frequency.
Exactly how magnets work. They just attract
right.
ideas and events. Yes. This is one of my favorite things where it's like you can say the most banal shit, but if you tell people that it's forbidden knowledge and it's been hidden from you by the powers that be, your idea will suddenly take on this like special magical property in people's brains.
It's just a secret between you and 30 million of your best friends.
All she's really saying is like try to have a positive attitude. Which, whatever, maybe that's true and maybe it's not, but it's like that is something that people have been saying for hundreds of years. There's nothing remotely
yeah.
unique or interesting about that idea.
Absolutely. But I think there's a nuance here because it's true that the functional takeaway here is have a positive attitude. But the core of this book is not about self-help, right? But what the secret is meant to be is a scientific claim
okay.
about the power of positive thinking being a real thing that really works.
Right.
Peppered throughout the explanations of the law of attraction are various extremely unsourced scientific claims by both Byrne
nice.
And her various co-experts.
Love it.
One dude says, quantum physicists tell us that the entire universe emerged from thought.
No.
I almost pulled a Michael Hobbs and reached out to a quantum physicist about this. And then I said, no, I'm not going to debase myself.
It started with thought.
Yeah. By the way, not the only time quantum physics is brought up. At one point,
love it.
The book is addressing the question of how long it takes to manifest what you want once you put mm-hmm. it out into the universe, right? Because that's sort of one of the obvious questions that flows from like, well, if I can just attract things into my life with my thoughts, mm-hmm. how long does it take, right? Does it come next year or whatever?
Right.
And Byrne says that Einstein told us that time is an illusion and that everything is happening simultaneously. And therefore, it takes no time for the universe to manifest what you want. The only obstacle is you truly believing it.
Not what Einstein said, but okay.
Yeah, not really what Einstein said. Also, does not make any practical sense. But there's only so much time I can spend on like every little time that she says something that made my head just spin around like The Exorcist. Before we get too far, maybe worth pausing to note that the book never explains anything about how the law of attraction works scientifically.
Oh, I'm livid. I would have loved like a long, like really try hard scientific explanation.
Like some physics diagrams. At certain points, it expressly says that you don't need to know how it works. You just need to know that it works.
Okay.
And there are hints that asking how it works is counterproductive because, quote, how it will happen, how the universe will bring it to you is not your concern or your job. When you are trying to work out how it will happen, you are emitting a frequency that contains a lack of faith.
Don't question it. Don't, if you think at all about like the rank pseudoscience that this is, you're actually denying it and it won't work for you.
I mean, yeah. If this is not working for you, if you're confused about it, that's actually you not having enough faith. And
totally.
The only way for it to work is for you to not question it.
It sounds like every religion and every diet. It's like, I'm going to sell you something that probably isn't true. And if you can't make it work for you, it's not the fault of the plan. It's the fault of you for not being able to implement this like Baroque deranged system of like scheduled things and fasting and like macronutrients.
I have texted you a couple of images, pages from the book.
Okay.
I imagine you will be unsettled from the first sentence onward.
So this is, I guess, a quote from Bill Harris, who's described as teacher and founder of Centerpoint Research Institute. Mm-hmm. It says, Robert was gay. He outlined all of the grim realities of his life in his emails to me. In his job, his coworkers ganged up on him. When he walked down the street, he was accosted by homophobic people who wanted to abuse him in some way. He wanted to become a stand-up comedian, and when he did a stand-up comedy job, everybody heckled him about being gay. His whole life was one of unhappiness and misery, and it all focused around being attacked because he was gay. I began to teach him that he was focusing on what he did not want. I directed him back to his email that he sent me and said, "Read it again. Look at all the things you do not want that you're telling me about. I can tell you're very passionate about this, and when you focus on something with a lot of passion, it makes it happen even faster." He started taking this thing about focusing on what you want to heart, and he began really trying it. What happened within the next 6 to 8 weeks was an absolute miracle. All the people in his office who had been harassing him either transferred to another department, quit working at the company, or started completely leaving him alone. He began to love his job. When he walked down the street, nobody harassed him anymore. They just weren't there. When he did his stand-up comedy routines, he started getting standing ovations and nobody was heckling him. His whole life changed because he changed from focusing on what he did not want, what he was afraid of, what he wanted to avoid, to focusing on what he did want.
Yeah. Thoughts?
This is true. Sounds totally nothing to pick at here.
This is my favorite anecdote in the whole book. It's so good. This dude cured homophobia through the power of the secret. He had his entire department restructured through the power of his mind. He willed a open mic stand-up comedy career into success.
The secret is so powerful that he somehow got a standing ovation at a comedy club. Something that does not happen.
Something that has never happened in the history of comedy clubs. So there's a lot going on here. One thing I want to use this to illustrate is that it's not just about the power of positive thinking per se. It's that whatever you think about, you attract to you. And that means when you focus on the negative, you're actually attracting those negative things into your life. So if you become obsessed with the people that street harass you, you're attracting street harassment. But if you visualize walking to work with no street harassment, you're attracting that. So that's the lesson. When you're getting homophobia done to you, you don't want to dwell on it. You just want to think positively. And you will eventually get all of your coworkers laid off.
I like how in the history of American victim blaming, we've gone from what was she wearing to what was he thinking? Huge progress. I'm also, I mean, obviously homophobia still existed in America in the early 2000s. But like, where was Robert getting constant street homophobic harassment?
Yeah, you don't want to downplay societal homophobia, but
I think better advice would have been like, move to San Francisco, Robert.
So the book spends a lot of time going over ways to harness the law of attraction, right? Meditating to clear your mind of bad thoughts, maintaining a mental catalog of happy thoughts.
Okay.
It is mostly throughout the book the same concept restated over and over. The interesting parts come when they are trying to discuss like the real world things that you can accomplish using the secret.
Okay.
Almost immediately, Byrne turns the discussion to making money. She claims that wealthy people use the secret, whether they know it or not, and that the key to being rich is just thinking about being rich and not thinking about being poor. One expert, quote unquote, says that wealth inequality is explained by the secret. Here's the quote. Why do you think that 1% of the population earns around 96% of all the money that's being earned? Do you think that's an accident? It's designed that way. They understand something.
Oh, hell yeah.
They understand the secret.
All those heirs to fortunes just have positive thinking, right. And that's the reason they get their, like, Mars dynasty money when their grandparents die? Yes.
I would give up everything I own to be able to go back in time and read that to Karl Marx. You get these, like, pearls of wisdom. Like, the only reason any person does not have enough money is because they are blocking money from coming to them with their thoughts.
Turns out you just don't want money.
That's the one thing.
Why hasn't anyone asked poor people to want money?
Their vibes are too negative, Michael.
We've talked on the show a lot about how most of the books that we cover, like, could have been magazine articles. Uh-huh. I feel like this is one that could have been just a bumper sticker. Like, I don't understand how you can pad this concept out to like 200 pages.
I mean, it could be a tweet that just says, get your vibes right.
Yeah.
That's it.
That was a clip from If Books Could Kill. It's hosted by Michael Hobbs and Peter Shamshiri. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend us your ears to this next podcast. If you recognize that line, it's probably because it was written by William Shakespeare, and whether it's in school or on stage or at the movies, most of us have encountered Shakespeare in some form or another. My first experience with Shakespeare was in high school. I'm guessing most people's was. But you might even find the Bard in some unexpected places, like California's Sentinella State Prison. In this clip from the Pushkin Industries podcast, Where There's a Will, Finding Shakespeare, we learn how performing Shakespeare can be transformative for incarcerated individuals. Let's take a listen.
The magic of being Shakespeare is Shakespeare writes on genuine humanity. So there's always the possibility of a connection in there. But the other magic of Shakespeare is it's hard, it's a puzzle, but because it's so distant, no one thinks they're talking about themselves. It's the trick. So that by the time we get to figuring out what's going on in the scene, it's so distant that we can pose a writing prompt that's so personal.
Here's John Quill again.
Shakespeare, it has a way of drawing you into the actual fold. So while you're acting, you're figuring out, well, how does this connect to my life? How can I connect this part to my life? What have I been through in this part of my life that reflects with this?
Whom have we have here? Did you not tell me this fat man was dead?
I did. I saw him dead, breathless and bleeding on the ground. Art thou alive?
So my story is, it's a strange one.
That's Ascari. I spoke with him by Zoom, so apologies for the sound of his audio, but I wanted to talk with him because he's a graduate of Reflecting Shakespeare. He's been involved with the justice system since 1984. He was a teenage gang member in Los Angeles. In 2022, after 27 years incarcerated in the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, the last seven of which were served at Sentinella, he was released He's just been hired as a teaching artist at the Old Globe, and he plans to return to Sentinella, not as an inmate, but as a Shakespeare teacher, so that he can share with the men still inside the kind of personal transformation he experienced.
If you're talking about Shakespeare, what you're really talking about is the human condition. And that gives an individual an opportunity to talk about, hey, this is the thing I've never been able to express about how I live, about the things that happened to me, and look in this story and you can see me there. People were able to see that and connect with that immediately.
Ascari had a job at Sentinella. He worked as a recreation clerk in the prison gym. One day, he watched a class of reflecting Shakespeare, and he remembered some Shakespeare he'd learned in school. So he spoke some.
I broke into to be or not to be. That is the question, whether it is noble in the minds of men to suffer the outrageous stings and arrows of misfortune or to bear arms against and by opposing end them. When I did that, they'd known that I had known something about Shakespeare.
I asked Ascari if there was a specific play that made an impression on him, that started to change him into a different person.
So Henry IV, that play, it connected with me in a real way because I consider Harry to be a man of destiny.
In his two Henry IV plays, Shakespeare tells a story of a young man who undergoes a gigantic change. Prince Hal, or Harry, reforms his ways. He redeems himself, and he transforms into a king, Henry V, a visionary, a leader, a hero. In connecting with a fictional transformation, Ascari had one of his own.
Something had to happen to him first. To go through all of that nonsense and tomfoolery when he was a child and when he was young and rebelling against his father. There are people who are destined to do something other than be mediocre. That play really resonated with me was that it was about that particular condition, about how you have to go through things. And I would just reflect about the things that I had to go through to become who I was.
So Prince Hal is a guy, nobody expects anything of him, right? Everybody knows he's going to be the king, but he's hanging out with Falstaff. He's hanging out in this bar. He's getting involved in all sorts of stuff that a prince shouldn't be doing. And his father tells him he's no good and that he's never going to amount to anything. He's going to embarrass the whole family and the whole monarchy. And yet he turns it around.
Right, right. He grew into this man of extreme courage, and he did what he had to do to save the country. And even when he was advised to do otherwise, he had right. to make the difficult decisions to go and do what needed to be done. And that really resonated with me because it's true in my own life that that's kind of the trajectory I took.
Do you know of other men who went through the Shakespeare program that had as deep a transformation as you did?
I don't know many who didn't. Honestly, I don't know many people who went from Shakespeare from class one to the end of the play who weren't changed by that experience. It's impossible not to be. It's just impossible not to be. But it's not simply Shakespeare. That's the secret sauce. Shakespeare is the linchpin. It's the cornerstone. It's the thing upon which you must build this other thing. But what happens in the room is people get to examine their humanity in ways that they were never able to. There's nothing there now that will permit you to examine your humanity like looking at Shakespeare and then talking about it from a personal perspective. Like, who are you? Who is the Othello in your life? Who is the Hamlet in your life? People, if you give people an opportunity to tell you what they know, they will. And you give a man in prison the opportunity to show you who he is, where it's safe to do so, and he will show you. But in doing that, he learns something about himself. He will see himself sometimes for the first time in his whole life. He'll see himself for who he really is and make a decision about whether or not that's who he wants to be going forward.
We happy few. We band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood's cheek, while any speaks the thought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world. That's Shakespeare's King Richard II. He's imprisoned and awaiting his death at the end of the play. He has this absolutely gorgeous speech. He conceives the inside of his cell as a mirror image of the world outside. Shakespeare uses prison as a metaphor in a few of his plays. Hamlet is one. He suggests that the finite space of a cell can be, paradoxically, infinite once the liberating powers of the mind set to work. I love this as a way of thinking about Shakespeare in prison programs like this one. In these bleak, airless places, Shakespeare becomes a conduit to something open-ended.
From Pushkin Industries, that was Where There's a Will, Finding Shakespeare. This episode was written and hosted by Barry Edelstein. Their team also includes M. Weinstein, Buffy Gorilla, Nisha Venkat, Jennifer Sanchez, and Salman Ahad Khan.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1986, 73 seconds after liftoff, NASA's Space Shuttle Challenger exploded on live television. The explosion killed all 7 of its crew members. Among them was Krista McAuliffe, a social studies teacher from New Hampshire and the selectee of Ronald Reagan's Teacher in Space project.
It's long been a goal of our space shuttle, the program to someday carry citizen passengers into space. Today, I'm directing NASA to begin a search to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
But before the Challenger tragedy was a years-long, heavily publicized selection process to choose the teacher who would go to space. Out of more than 10,000 applicants, NASA chose 10 finalists to participate in weeks of rigorous testing and training. NASA called it Space Camp, but the process was far from fun and games. In this clip from the Slate podcast, One Year 1986, we hear about that experience from the former candidates themselves.
We were having some difficulty dealing with some of the stress. You know, it was really hard in some respects. So we developed a system of secret buddies. We would do little things for our secret buddies, send them a little flower or an encouraging note or a card or something every day to just help us get through the pressure. And that's how we got to be really close. We're still close.
Of the 10, I would say I got closest to Krista McAuliffe. Krista and I always wound up together, elbowing each other or giving each other mischievous looks. I don't know, we just clicked. We just became good friends.
For anyone who wishes to respond, do you think that you've survived the tough part, or is the tough part still to come?
Well, I think we're all looking forward to the KC-135 flight.
Of course, part of the attraction of going into space is to be able to experience weightlessness.
There's one way on Earth that you can reproduce the weightlessness that only a handful of people have ever experienced in space, and that's in this plane.
On the KC-135.
And that's the plane that does parabolic dips and gives you about 20 to 30 seconds worth of weightlessness. So we'll see how people like that real quick.
Some of the instructors said, you know, you don't see us standing in line to go on board the KC-135.
Yes, it's usually referred to as the vomit comet.
So here we are, nervously chomping on our gum.
And when they pull up, you feel like you can't even get off the floor. Your arms are so heavy, you can't lift them. But then as you get to the apex and then you head down again, then all of a sudden you feel yourself getting lighter and lighter, and the next thing you know, you're floating.
I was airborne, and I've got the biggest smile that I think I've ever smiled.
You're bouncing off the walls and you're hitting people and they're hitting you and there's people all over the place.
I went to the back and pushed off and, you know, went flying through the length of the fuselage looking like Clark Kent. So.
And we sound like kindergartners at recess. We're screaming, we're yelling, we're having so much fun.
Oh, you just don't want it to end.
The birthplace of America's space program.
Well, we went to Huntsville, Alabama, visited a new enterprise called Space Camp.
See Space Camp, Space Shuttle, Space Dome Theater, and tour NASA's largest training and test site area.
We wore our flight suits. They gave us all flight suits.
And then there was lots of press, lots of media.
Of course, they all wanted to go to space before, but now that the possibility of that is very real, well, just ask the teachers.
To be up there, to look back at the planet Earth, it's an ultimate trip. It's the ultimate experience of a lifetime.
I don't like to use the word celebrities, but we were, I guess, notorious in the news at that point.
The thing I can do out there, and that's get kids excited to watch out there and see why this frontier is so valuable.
I think it kept settling into us that, wow, this is something that's getting big.
John Denver was there.
John Denver always wanted to travel in space. Music was his number one love, and number two was space. I guess they should have had the first musician in space.
But he was with us for a part of that day, and of course, we're thrilled to death. He gave us all his private phone number. He said, anytime I can do anything for you, you just give me a call. He was just great.
One of the last items on our agenda at Space Camp was to experience the gravity and the centrifuge.
This was a giant rotating cylinder. The floor drops away, and because you're going so fast, you'll hang on to the sides, you stick there. And we were accompanied by some Space Camp counselors.
They were engineering students. They all wore these red flight suits, and they would stand on the handrests for more thrill. And I remember one particular engineering student was really kind, and he said, is this too tight? And I said, no, you can make it tighter. I don't want to be going anywhere. And so we were all strapped in, ready to go. It was dark in there, and you spin around slowly. And we spun around, you know, faster. All of a sudden, there was a loud boom.
I heard a thump, 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 and somebody shrieked, he went over.
All of a sudden, the speed decreased, the lights came on, and I looked up and, oh my God, the poor young engineer in the red flight suit that was so concerned about strapping me in correctly had catapulted out through the dome and onto the floor.
And what this student had done had used his knees to sort of, with his back against the wall of this rotating chamber, had kind of climbed up And when he got to the top, enough of his body got over the rim that it threw him off and just got, I don't know, and killed him. NASA very quickly rushed us out of there, and we were, of course, everybody was completely shaken and just devastated.
The person thrown into the ride's machinery was named Gregory Todd Walker. He was a 20-year-old student at Auburn University, working a summer job at space camp. His death in July 1985 got a few paragraphs in the local newspapers, but otherwise wasn't written about that summer. None of the articles mentioned that the teacher and space candidates were there.
No, I just felt heartbreak for this kid, but it was terrible. It affected us all. It did. It stuck with us for a long time.
Yeah, that was a dark moment on our trip. You know, there's some life and death things that happen here.
After the shocking death in Huntsville, the teacher and space finalists flew to Washington, D.C. for their final interviews. Soon, NASA would decide which teacher got to fly aboard the Challenger.
The toughest test for the teachers is yet to come. Not weightlessness, but waiting.
The decision is expected July the 19th.
We're all realizing it's come down to this. I think we all thought it was just up for grabs. The commander of the Challenger flight would be Dick Scobee.
First 2 minutes of flight, when the solid rocket motors are still attached, because of all the fire and brimstone, the whole stack just shakes and vibrates, and it feels like being on a rough railroad track on a runaway freight train or something.
And we went to Dick Scobee's hotel room.
He stared and met with each of our eyes, and he said, "There are no guarantees for round trips." And it's one hell of a big firecracker that's going to be lit.
He said, "It's a dangerous operation. You know, don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
So don't go unless you're prepared that something could go terribly wrong."
That's about as straightforward as you can get. I mean, to have the captain of the ship tell you that straight up in his hotel room, you're going to believe him.
But I think we were in a place where we wanted to go so badly. You know, you wonder how much you processed.
Well, I think when you want something badly enough, you're willing to take whatever risk there is. And it was a dream. It was for all of us. It was, you know, when you have a dream, you're willing to risk for it.
That was 1 year, 1986, from Slate. That story was told by Evan Chung. Their team also includes Josh Levine, Sophie Summergrad, Sam Kim, Madeline Ducharme, Derek John, and Merritt Jacob. This episode featured interviews with Kathleen Beers, Robert Forster, and Nancy Wanger. Alberta Williams described her as fun, caring, and kind-hearted. She was close with her family, and she dreamed of traveling and becoming a nurse. Alberta was murdered in 1989 when she was just 24 years old, adding her name to the long list of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. The case went cold until 2015 when Cree journalist Connie Walker got an email with the subject line, "Alberta Williams Murder." The email contained just one sentence, the name of Alberta's alleged killer. At the time, Connie was working as an investigative reporter at CBC News, and that one-line email sent her straight into the web of a mystery that had been unsolved for decades. Here's a clip from the first episode of the CBC podcast, Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams?
I met Alberta's sister, Claudia Williams, at a park near her house in Vancouver. It was a gorgeous spring day. and we sat on a bench surrounded by cherry blossoms, with a children's play structure just a few feet away.
And one day we got an email from somebody, and the subject said Alberta Williams murder. And in the body, it said she was killed by, and the email named a person. And I think you know the person I'm referring to.
Yeah, I do.
Claudia only sort of remembers Gary. It was 27 years ago, and her parents, Lawrence and Rena, were the ones that had the most contact with the RCMP. Both of her parents have since died, and now Claudia feels it's her responsibility to try to get justice for her sister. And since the night Alberta disappeared, she's also had her suspicions about who killed her.
Does it surprise you that he says he thinks he knows who's responsible for Alberta's death?
No, doesn't surprise me at all.
Why not?
Simply because, you know, for me, I know myself. You know, it's a matter of evidence and all of that. I know for myself that, you know, Alberta didn't just go missing. She didn't just go missing, and she didn't just walk away. You know, she trusted what she did.
She trusted the person?
Yeah, she did. She knew the person. She trusted the person. Nothing to fear. Yeah, and not only that, I was with her that night.
Claudia and Alberta spent a lot of time together. In 1989, they both lived in Vancouver, Alberta with her boyfriend and Claudia with her young son.
What else? Tell me a bit about her. How would you describe her personality?
Fun. A lot of fun. She never took anything serious. She is so much fun. Even if somebody pissed her off, she'd shrug it off. That's the way she is. She's just very caring.
With her parents, she was close. They were a very close-knitted family.
Geraldine Morrison was Alberta's best friend. They lived right next door to each other growing up.
But yeah, we went out picking berries, walked along tracks, did a lot of walking. Mostly babysitting.
I did a lot of babysitting when I was a kid with my cousin, too. And we also lived right next door to each other.
Yeah, that's how we were. Yeah, if we did, like, we'd bang on the wall, we'd have a certain bang that we'd call each other's. Yeah, when we were ready and we've done our chores and everything, because we didn't have a phone. And we weren't allowed to step out the door unless all our chores were done. And we also helped, like, with our parents being in the fishing industry, and we helped look after each other's families. Mm. Yeah, she was very helpful that way.
What were Alberta's dreams? What did she want to be doing?
Well, when we were younger, she used to always talk about traveling. Getting away from the small villages and just travel. We used to talk about being nurses.
Do you think Alberta would have been a good nurse?
Yeah, I think so. Just because she was so kind-hearted and she had a lot of empathy with her.
Was she a good friend?
Every time I drive by or go to Prince Rupert, she's on my mind.
There's only one road into Prince Rupert, along Highway 16. It's a windy road, with mountains on one side and the Skeena River on the other. In 1989, Alberta and Claudia were struggling to make ends meet in the big city. The sisters decided to return home for the summer, to Prince Rupert, to make some money. The Daily News in Prince Rupert calls the port city the key to the Great Northwest. And if you don't know it, it's a pretty remote spot in northern British Columbia, about halfway up the coast. Back then, it was a boom town, packed with people migrating there to work in the fishing industry, on boats or in the canneries, like Alberta and Claudia. At the same time, Gary Kerr was a young constable, stationed at the RCMP post right downtown.
And at that time there in the RCMP, there was only two of us that were working in plain clothes. At the time, it was called a general investigation section. Now you'd call it maybe a major crime unit or something, but there was only two of us. And so then we started the investigation into Alberta. And at the time she went missing, she was going to school in Vancouver, and she had come back to Prince Rupert to work in the fish plants or fish cannery for the summer, because the fish canneries at the time were literally going 100 miles an hour. Prince Rupert was a crazy town at the time. It was extremely busy. It was just a crazy, wild place.
Working in the cannery was hard. And by the end of August, both sisters were looking forward to going back to Vancouver. But it was time for one last night out.
Tell us what happened on the last night that you saw Alberta.
The last night that I saw Alberta was actually our last day of the cannery. It was payday, time to come back to Vancouver. And then, you know, everybody kind of, you know, oh, we're going to go here, we're going to go there, we're going to go to the cabaret, I'll go to Bogey's, big cabaret in Prince Rupert.
It was called Bogey's?
Yeah.
I'm going to stop here and admit that I'm still confused about the bar that Alberta and Claudia went to that night. Claudia says it was Bogey's, but the first time I talked to Gary, he called it Popeye's. Both bars were in the old Prince Rupert Hotel. One was upstairs and one was downstairs. I've discovered that you can use the names interchangeably. If you say Bogey's or Popeye's, locals will know what you mean. And by all accounts, it was the place to be on a Friday night at the end of summer.
And, you know, everybody was in Bogey's, you know, table full of people, probably a couple of tables pulled together. I knew everybody at that table. So did she. And it was quite packed, the tables, and I thought, well, you know what, they're already ahead of the game, they're laughing. And
how was Alberta that night? How was she doing?
Good. She was having a good time. She was having a good time. She was, you know, I was looking at everybody else, but then I stood there and looked at her, and she was laughing so hard, you know, I just smiled, you know, just let her know I'm here. And, you know, I just roamed around, came back again, stood there.
You're keeping an eye on her?
Yeah. I don't know. Something told me just keep an eye on her. So I did. You know, other than that, you know, if I was going to leave, I would have told her, hey, you know what, this is a bit boring for me. I'm going home. But that's the way we were. We let each other know where we're going, what we're doing.
I tracked down a few other people who were there that night. Hello?
Hi, is this Eva?
Hi, Eva, it's Connie calling. Thank you so much for calling back.
Uh-huh.
People who knew Alberta and remember seeing her there. Do you remember?
Uh-huh.
Do you remember Alberta?
Yeah.
Eva didn't want us to use her last name, but she was at the bar that night, a designated driver. I've never been to that bar. What was it like?
Everybody liked to hang around there. I mean, go there and meet their friends.
Was it popular?
Popular place, yep.
And do you remember seeing Alberta that night?
Yes, I did. She was sitting at the same table. Only all the tables were joined together. They put their tables together, so it was quite a big, long table.
Everyone describes it as busy. Lots of people, and a band playing. Geraldine Morrison says Alberta was in a good mood that night.
We were all sitting around, drinking, dancing, laughing around, just talking with everybody. And everybody that was there was all happy. I hadn't seen her for a while, and it was real nice to see her and her sisters.
Was she having fun that night?
Yes. Yes, we were. It was crazy. Lots of girls. A lot of girl talk. But, yeah, everything was going as the way it should have been going.
I found this interesting or odd, but Claudia never sat at the table with the group. But she says she watched them and Alberta all night.
Did you trust everyone at the table that she was
I
with?
Had no reason not to distrust anybody. I had no reason. They didn't give me any reason at the time. not to trust anybody. To me, it's a bunch of friends getting together. One last night, and unfortunately, that was one last night for her.
Claudia, Alberta, and most of the group at the table stayed at the bar for hours. They stayed until after the band finished, after last call, until closing time.
So that last night in Prince Rupert, what happened at the end of the cabaret?
At the end of the cabaret, everybody walked up those stairs, and then outside, and there was a bunch of people to my left. Alberta was maybe from here to you, but this way. And I was standing there, and then I thought, well, what now? And I said, we have to get back to Vancouver. And Alberta said, come with us, we're going to a party. And she told me where the party was.
She said who was hosting the party.
Yeah, she said who was hosting the party. And then in between her saying that and my head turning like this, and then she said, Claudia, and she goes, come with me. And then, you know, I just looked and I said a couple of words to my boyfriend. I turned around. In that sort of time, she was gone.
From the CBC, that was Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams. The show is written and hosted by Connie Walker. It's produced by Marnie Luke and Lori Ward, and their team also includes Ashley Walters, Cecil Fernandez, Harold Dupuy, and Arif Noorani. If a dead person was telling you to do something, would you do it? That's not just a question for horror movie protagonists. It's a very real legal issue that has huge implications today. Charitable trusts are a way for philanthropists to donate massive amounts of money even after they've died. In these cases, the word of a dead person becomes law. But dead people have no idea how the world is going to change, and often the charitable trusts they leave behind are stuck in the past. So, how long are we obligated to listen to them? And how much control should we give to people beyond the grave? Here's the podcast, Future Perfect, with that story.
There was an interesting case in Georgia involving Senator Bacon, who was very interested in providing this beautiful, beautiful park to his town, and he donated this land.
This is 1911. Bacon sets up a trust, and Baconsfield Park opens in 1920. It is gorgeous. 75 acres of land, there are athletic fields, there are swing sets, a clay tennis court, a bamboo thicket. I actually have an old postcard of it, if you want to look at that.
Oh, wow. This is really nice. There's this little island with a tree in it and flowers around the tree and like a little bridge made of earth that people can walk along. It's really lovely.
Yeah, apparently there were almost 600 rose bushes, which sounds really nice too.
This seems like a really nice gift for your community.
When he made the gift, he said it was for the sole, perpetual, and unending use, benefit, enjoyment of white women, white girls, white boys, and white children of the city of Macon.
Senator Bacon was a veteran of the Confederate Army. And like many people in the 1910s, he was an open racist. So he built his racism right into his trust. And throughout the first half of the 1900s, the park's trustees dutifully enforced that racism.
Of course, 50 years later, racially segregated public parks were no longer either socially or legally accepted.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
The question of what to do with Baconsfield Park ended up at the Supreme Court not once, but twice. First in 1966, and then in 1969. In the first case, the 1966 one, the question was, can Bakersfield Park be whites only? And the Supreme Court said, no, that violates the 14th Amendment. So the trustees of the park said, fine, if the park can't be whites only, then we can't follow the terms in Senator Bacon's will. So we want to give Bakersfield Park back to Bacon's heirs, and they can do whatever they want with it. Civil rights activists were like, hold on, what? No, let's not give the park back. The trust should just be changed to get rid of the racist part, which is why the park returned to the Supreme Court in 1969.
Now, as my adversaries emphasize, Bacon quite plainly stated that he did not want Negroes to use this park.
This is James Neipperth III, a civil rights attorney. And the second case also centers around a big 14th Amendment question, but they take a kind of interesting detour to talk about what Bacon would have wanted.
We cheerfully concede that it violates Bacon's solemn intent for Negroes to use this park. But we also want it to be clear. Bacon's will provided that the land should be forever used and enjoyed as a park and pleasure ground. And he said that under no circumstances should it be sold or alienated.
Neipperth is saying, listen, in Bacon's vision for his park, he had two forever wishes. One, that it be for whites only, but the other, that it exist forever as a park.
But he never contemplated this situation. This will contains nothing to indicate that Bacon preferred that his park be destroyed and revert to his heirs rather than to have Negroes use it.
So Neipperth says, just cut the racist forever wish out of the will. We shouldn't be constrained by a dead man's racist ideas anyway.
That our courts can't be used by dead men to perpetuate their bigotry in the law. Racism has to die with the bigot. The legal system can't give it perpetuity.
But faced with these two incompatible forever wishes, the park and the racism, the Supreme Court ultimately said the trustees can decide that the racist wish is more important here. They said that the park could be taken away from the city. And so it was. The land went back to Senator Bacon's heirs.
Who then sold it, and now you can see it's an office park. It's no longer a park.
No more bamboo thickets, no more public rose bushes and tennis courts. Where the park once was, there is a Kroger's, an apartment complex, and a bunch of offices.
And it's really a terrible thing to have happened. And it happened because of some peculiar idea that the thing that we should be doing is looking at what somebody who had died more than 50 years earlier would have wanted, even though the times had changed considerably.
That was Future Perfect from Vox. The show is produced and reported by Bird Pinkerton and Dylan Matthews. Their team also includes Amy Drozdowska, Jillian Weinberger, Jared Paul, and Ben Soskiss. This episode features an interview with Ray Madoff. That's it for Podcast Playlist this week. If you want to hear more about any of these shows, you can find more information on our website at cbc.ca/podcastplaylist. And if you like what you heard, please follow us on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Podcast Playlist is Aili Yamamoto and Julian Uzielli, with technical support from Emily Chiarvasio. Our senior producer is Kate Evans. Our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.